Blog Talk Radio.
Fiducia.
And I'm Don Newen, ladies and gentlemen. We're from Cowboy Logic Radio.
And you're listening to James Bostic.
A conservative's perspective.
Right here on Red Nation Rising Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Conservative's perspective here on the Red Nation Rising Radio Network, also found on the Internet Conservative Radio Network, WSTR. Digital broadcasting, our buddy Rocky Stucci's outfit, proud to be a part of all these things. And as if that weren't enough, and it probably is, we are also doing two live shows, Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Patriot Nation Radio Network. And you can find the Patriot Nation Radio Network and the Conservative's Perspective, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at Blog Talk Radio. I am firmly ensconced in my county school board mandated spring break. No, I'm not in school, but I work in the school system. And so this week here in the Mountain State, we're on spring break, and it's we've been blessed with good weather. Got to mow a little grass today, and got a few things I'm going to be doing around the house, spring cleaning, and the weather looks like it's going to be cooperative. But as it would stand for right now, my ability to sleep is not being very cooperative at all. So here I am on midnight. A lot of things have happened in the last couple of weeks. I have been focused a lot and talked a lot about the ideological and the cultural divide between the hard left, the Tom Perez's and the Keith Ellison's of the Democrat Party, and the rest of us, the two Americas. We've talked about the two Americas. I talked about that last weekend with Daniel Greenfield, had a great article on it, and we may go back over that here in a little bit. But I want to talk about Susan Rice. I want to talk about this is basically what's happening here, and this is an article that I found. It was from about a week ago by a fellow by the name of Andrew McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy was a White House guy back in the old-timey days, so he knows his way around, and he knows a lot about Susan Rice, and he understands how these things work. And this was an article that he wrote for National Review, and you can find it at nationalreview.com. You can also find it at probably frontpagemagazine.com. That's where I pick up a lot of things from some really, really smart writers. American Thinker is another good site. Drudge, Breitbart, two excellent aggregate sites. Truth Revolt. All these are great places to look for this kind of stuff. And it's not like I come up with it. You know what? I don't have any more talent than a guy like Don Lemon. I'm just a news reader, and then I talk about how it sets with me, or I share it with you because it's resonated. Now, the thing to bear in mind is that the White House does not do investigations, not criminal investigations, not intelligence investigations, okay? The White House does not do investigations, not criminal investigations, not intelligence investigations. It's important that we remember that. Why is that so important in the context of these revelations that Susan Rice, President Obama's National Security Advisor, confidant, and chief dissembler, why did she call for the unmasking of Trump campaign and transition officials whose identities and communications were captured in the collection of U.S. intelligence on foreign targets? Well, it's important because we've been told for weeks that any unmasking of people in Donald Trump's circle that may have occurred had two very innocent explanations. Number one, the FBI's investigation of Russian meddling in the election. And number two, the need to know, for purposes of understanding the communications of foreign intelligence targets, the identities of Americans incidentally intercepted or mentioned. The unmasking, Obama apologists insist, had nothing to do with targeting Trump or Donald Trump's people. Well, that won't wash. In general, it is the FBI that conducts investigations that bear on American citizens suspected of committing crimes or of acting as agents of foreign powers. In the matter of alleged Russian meddling, the investigative camp also includes the CIA and the NSA. All three agencies conducted a probe and issued a joint report in January. That was after Obama, despite having previously acknowledged that Russian activity was inconsequential, suddenly made a great show about ordering an inquiry and issuing sanctions against Russia because of said intervention. Consequently, if unmasking was relevant to the Russia investigation, it would have been done by those agencies. And if it had been critical to know the identities of Americans caught up in other foreign intelligence efforts, the agencies that collect the information and conduct investigations would have unmasked it. The agencies that collect the information and conduct investigations would have unmasked it. Remember what we said at the beginning of this whole deal? Was that the White House does not do investigations, not criminal investigations, not intelligence investigations. Because they are the agencies that collect and refine the intelligence products for the rest of the intelligence community. They're responsible for any unmasking, and they do it under minimization standards that FBI Director James Comey, in recent congressional testimony, described as obsessive in their determination to protect the identities and the privacy of Americans. So again, what we need to understand is this. There would have been no intelligence need for Susan Rice to ask for identities to be unmasked. If there had been a real need to reveal these identities, an intelligence need based on American interests, well, then in that case, the unmasking would have been done by the investigating agencies. The National Security Advisor is not an investigator. She is a White House staffer. The President's staff in the White House is a consumer of intelligence products, not a generator or collector of intelligence. if Susan Rice was unmasking Americans, and apparently she was, it was not to fulfill an intelligence need based on American interests. It was to fulfill a political desire based on Democrat Party interests. The FBI, the CIA, and NSA generator collect the intelligence in essentially three ways. Conducting surveillance on suspected agents of foreign powers under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, and carrying out more sweeping collections under two other authorities, a different provision of the FISA, and a Reagan-era executive order that's been amended several times over the ensuing decades, and that's Executive Order 12,333. Now, as FBI Director Comey explains in answering questions posed by Representative Trey Gowdy, those three agencies do collection, investigation, and analysis in general. They handle any necessary unmasking, which, due to the aforementioned privacy obsessiveness, is extremely rare. Unlike Democratic Party operatives whose obsession is vanquishing Republicans, the three agencies have to be concerned about the privacy rights of America. If they're not, their legal authority to collect intelligence, a vital national security power, could be severely curtailed when it periodically comes up for review by Congress, as it will later this year. Those three collecting agencies, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, they have to be distinguished from other components of the government, like the White House. Those other components, Comey elaborated, are consumers of the products. That is, they don't collect raw intelligence and refine it into useful reports. In other words, reports that balance informational value and the necessary privacy protections. They read those reports, and they make policy recommendations based on them. But White House staffers are not supposed to be in the business of controlling the content of the reports. They merely act on the reports. Thus, Comey added, these consumers can ask the collectors to unmask, but the unmasking authority resides with those who collect the information. Now, of course, the consumer doing the asking in this case was not just any government flunky. This was Susan Rice. This was Obama's right hand doing the asking. If she made an unmasking request, who, if anyone, do you suppose at the FBI, CIA, or NSA was going to tell her no? Now, that brings us to three interesting points. The first point involves political intrusion into law enforcement, something that the White House is supposed to avoid. You may remember that Democrats ran Bush Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez out of town over suspicions about that. And as has been noted, in publishing the illegally leaked classified information about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's communications with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, the New York Times informs us that Obama advisors and, quote, Obama officials were up to their eyeballs in the investigation. Quote, Obama advisors heard separately from the FBI about Mr. Flynn's conversation with Mr. Kislyak, whose calls were routinely monitored by American intelligence agencies that track Russian diplomats. The Obama advisors grew suspicious that perhaps there had been a secret deal between the incoming team and Moscow, which could violate the rarely enforced two-century-old Logan Act, barring private citizens from negotiating with foreign powers in disputes with the United States. The Obama officials asked the FBI if a quid pro quo had been discussed on the call, and the answer came back no, according to one of the officials, who, like the others, asked not to be named, discussing delicate communications. Translation, asking not to be named committing a felony, unauthorized disclosure of classified information is what that means. The topic of sanctions came up, they were told, but there was no deal. It appears very likely that Susan Rice was involved in the unmasking of Michael Flynn as well. Was she also monitoring the FBI's investigation? Was she involved in the administration's consideration of bogus criminal charges against Flynn? With the subsequent decision to have the FBI interrogate Flynn, did she play a role in that as well? The second point is that while not exactly what one would describe as a pillar of rectitude, Ms. Rice is also not stupid. Besides being shrewd, she is a highly involved, highly informed consumer of intelligence and a key Obama political collaborator. Unlike the casual reader, she would have known who the Trump team players were without needing to have their identities unmasked. You really think her purpose in demanding that names be revealed was to enhance her understanding of intelligence about the activities and intentions of foreign targets? Really? Well, I think that it was done so that others down the dissemination chain could see the names of Trump associates. Names the investigating agencies that originally collected this information had determined not to unmask. Third, and finally, let's consider the dissemination chain Rice had in mind. The most telling remark that former Obama Deputy Defense Secretary Evelyn Farkas made in her now infamous MSNBC interview, and we're going to play that, was the throwaway line at the very end of it, which was, "That's why you have all the leaking." We're going to play that clip soon as we get done with this. So put this in context. Evelyn Farkas had left the Obama administration in 2015, subsequently joining the presidential campaign of, yes, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump's opponent. She told MSNBC that she had been encouraging her former Obama administration colleagues and members of Congress to seek as much information as you can from the intelligence community. That's why you have the leaking. So to summarize, at a high level, officials like Susan Rice had names unmasked that would not ordinarily be unmasked. That information was then being pushed widely throughout the intelligence community in unmasked form, particularly after Obama, toward the end of his presidency, suddenly, and seemingly apropos of nothing, changed the rules so that all the intelligence agencies, not just the collecting agencies, could have access to raw intelligence information. As we know, the community of intelligence agencies leaks like a sieve. And the more access there is to juicy information, the more leaks there are. Meanwhile, former Obama officials and Clinton campaign advisors like Evelyn Farkas were pushing to get the information transferred from the intelligence community to members of Congress, geometrically increasing the likelihood of intelligence leaks. By the way, have you noticed that there have been lots of intelligence leaks in the press? There's an old saying in the criminal law, and that is the best evidence of a conspiracy is success. Criminal law also has another good rule of thumb, and that is consciousness of guilt is best proved by the false exculpatory statements that are made. And that is a genre in which Susan Rice has rich experience. About 3 weeks ago, she was asked in an interview about allegations by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes of California, you know, whether or not the Obama administration had unmasked Trump team members. She said, "I know nothing about this." I was surprised to see reports from Chairman Nunes on that count today. Well, at least she didn't blame a video.
I don't know.
And by the way, has anybody seen Barry lately? Is he still off in Tahiti with his buddy? Some guy, ostensibly, I think they're out there writing yet another memoir. But he's off in Tahiti. You haven't heard much out of the Obama family here. Malia and and Michelle and the other girl, oh, what's her name? They've just been laying around kind of quiet. I guess they're still in Washington. I haven't heard anything from them. But they've been gone for a few weeks, and out of the public eye, while all this is happening, isn't that so weird? So the president can't answer, the former president can't answer any questions about this. And, you know, what about this, people? What if he went off knowing this was going to happen? And he's got to come back sooner or later. But as we have seen through 8 years of his presidency, he is capable of tremendous levels of avoidance coupled with out-and-out barefaced lying. Maybe he's not, who knows what he's doing out there, man. Maybe he's just, you know, got an orchid behind one ear and wearing a sarong and blowing a conch shell or, what you know, whatever they do out there, and he's just hanging out, man. Don't want to come back. Tahiti's more Hawaii than Hawaii, and you know how much he loves Hawaii. I'm not exactly sure how much he loves Michelle and the girls. He's probably had enough of them after 8 years of being up each other's behinds 24/7 in the White House. I understand why he would get rid of them for a few weeks at a time and send Michelle on a trip. Believe me, I understand. And as a man, I'm not going to fault him for that. But there, and besides, there are plenty of other things to fault him for. But have you noticed that? He's still not around. He's been gone for 2 or 3 weeks while all this has been blowing up all over the place and bubbling and brewing. Not a peep from the Obamas. Yay. I'm happy. But still, I'm also understandably curious as what's he going to say when he comes back. He's got to come back sooner or later. These things are going to come up. He's going to have to address them. At some point, he's just going to ask it because they're going to ask him about it. He's going to want to go on news shows, and they're going to want to talk to him about it, and he's not going to be able to say, well, no, I'm not going to talk about that. I don't want to talk about that, John. But and they're going to want to, and there's going to reach a point where even as sycophantic as they are towards he and Hillary both, I mean, they're in the tank for the left all the way, the mainstream media. Sooner or later, people are going to want to ask these questions. And if congressional committees get involved in it, then everybody's going to lawyer up, and that would include the president, Susan Rice, Evelyn Farkas, who I'm sure is already lawyered up. I have a clip to share with you. If you didn't see it, if you haven't seen it, Sean Hannity breaks this thing down with Evelyn Farkas. And what I want to tell you about, as it stands right now statistically in the United States, the average median age is 37.5 years old. The Watergate scandal that all these news people think they know about began June 17, 1972, when five guys were arrested for burglarizing the Democrat National Committee headquarters, which at that time was located in the Watergate Hotel. Long story short, ostensibly, there was a group known as the Committee to Re-elect the President. And one of the principals of that group was a man named George Gordon Battle Liddy, G. Gordon Liddy, a great American and a hell of a man. If you ever get a chance, you need to read his autobiography called Will, W-I-L-L. And it's a tremendous story about his life. He was a former FBI agent and came from the right family, had the right education. But unlike a lot of those fellas, Gordon was tough as nails. And he and a couple other fellas, Bernard Baker, Jim McCordy, Howard Hunt, who was a former CIA agent, they had this idea. Well, anyway, they got caught up in it. And it was through the FBI investigation of the burglars themselves and the paper trail and the cash that these guys wound up with, you know, they realized that this came from a slush fund, which was handled by the Committee to Re-elect President Nixon. In 1972, for those of you who weren't around, we were still embroiled in Vietnam, the quagmire of Vietnam, as the Democrats love to come when they compare any military intervention or military action that's taken place ever since. They don't want it to turn into the quagmire of Vietnam, but they don't tell you that it was the Democrats that generated that quagmire. Lyndon Johnson generated that and escalated it after Kennedy was assassinated. What was involved in the Watergate break-in was they were going to plant microphones. And they were also looking at donor lists. It was an intelligence gathering operation conducted by this committee to reelect Richard Nixon. And they got caught. What happened in 1972 is still hailed as the political scandal of all time. The end-all, be-all of political scandals because it involved a Republican and the leftists and the Democrats. You know, never mind that Hillary Clinton sold out 25% of our uranium reserves to a company that she knew was going to be sold and absorbed by the Russian atomic corporation. It's not really a regulatory agency, but Rosatom is their atomic energy go-to people. And it was sold to them. Lots of big scandals. Fast and Furious, huge scandal. What happened with the Tea Party groups and the IRS? Huge scandal. Bigger than Watergate, trust me. Much bigger than Watergate because of what was done. What we see now is the kind of stuff that dictators and third world tin pot types try to do. And that's what Barack Obama did. And he had his henchmen do it. Here's the thing, guys. It's just like, and I've talked about this on several shows. I'm going to talk about it again because we need to. These Obama people that are embedded within the government, and we'll talk about this some more coming up after the break, if I go to a break. I'm not exactly sure I'm going to go to a break. But anyway, these people that were left behind, these loyalists, are working within the duly elected government to try to circumvent and overthrow it. And they're like the mythical Hydra. You know what I'm talking about? That from mythology, the multi-headed serpent. If you got into a fight with it and you managed to cut one of its heads off, well, two more would grow back in its place. A couple of years ago, the greatest of my childhood superheroes came to life on the big screen. I'm talking about Captain America. And in the second movie that they did focusing on Captain America, it was called The Winter Soldier. And in the original movie, you know, the organization, it was a Nazi-inspired organization led by his nemesis, the Red Skull, and it was called Hydra. And that was what they said when they were caught, and, you know, they had to take the cyanide capsule and cut off one head, two more grow back in its place. And then they would die and leave a really irritated Captain America to, now he's got to go out and beat up two more guys. Which he could do. Cap was good at that. So that's what's happening. And that's what's happened. And that's where these leaks are coming from. You have these loyalists within the state. Evelyn Farkas was a deputy assistant to a secretary, to an assistant secretary of state. She was a deputy assistant. Secretary of, I mean, it was either State Department or Defense. Maybe it was Defense. But she would have had regular routine contact with her counterpart in the State Department. And Evelyn Farkas was at the Defense Department at the same time Hillary Clinton was rubber stamping this deal between Uranium One and Rosatom at State. And her specialty were former Warsaw Pact countries, like Georgia, the Crimea, and those areas. I guess it was that Asia Minor, is that what they call it? Anyway, but so the Warsaw Pact, the southeastern Warsaw Pact nations, and like I said, Crimea and those places. And we have her interview. As a matter of fact, I'm just going to go ahead and play the interview. This was something, and Sean Hannity does a terrific job of breaking this whole thing down. I've got the clip loaded up. It's about 8 minutes. I'm going to go ahead and play it for you and let you hear it again. At the end of it, you'll hear Evelyn Farkas herself say, and that's the reason behind all the leaking, or whatever it is she says. Let me pull that up for you.
All right, last night on this program, we showed you a video of a former Obama official, Evelyn Farkas, from earlier this month, saying that she urged her former colleagues and people on the Hill to get as much information and intelligence as they could on the Trump team before President Obama left office. Now, on March 2nd, during an NBC interview, Dr. Farkas, who served in the Obama administration from 2012 through 2015 as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, listen to these comments very, very closely. Listen.
I was urging my former colleagues and frankly speaking, the people on the Hill. Mm-hmm. It was more actually aimed at telling the Hill people, get as much information as you can, get as much intelligence as you can before President Obama leaves the administration, because I had a fear that somehow that information would disappear with the senior people who left. So it would be hidden away in the bureaucracy, that the Trump folks, if they found out how we knew what we knew about the staff, the Trump staff dealing with Russians, that they would try to compromise those sources and methods, meaning we would no longer have access to that intelligence. So I became very worried because not enough was coming out into the open, and I knew that there was more. We have very good intelligence on Russia. So then I had talked to some of my former colleagues, and I knew that they were trying to also help get information to the Hill.
How we knew what we knew about the Trump staff's dealing with Russia. All right, let's deal with what Evelyn Farkas is saying here. First, she's admitting what we've been saying, what Sarah Carter, John Solomon, James Rosen have all been saying. Surveillance took place. Take a watch.
It was more actually aimed at telling the Hill people, get as much information as you can, get as much intelligence as you can before President Obama leaves the administration, because I had a fear that somehow that information would disappear with the senior people.
Oh, that's the intelligence she wants her friends on Capitol Hill to get. Is that the information she's talking about? Now, next, she admits there was unmasking. That shouldn't happen. Watch.
That the Trump folks, if they found out how we knew what we knew about the Trump staff dealing with Russians, that they would try to compromise those sources and methods, meaning we would no longer have access to that intelligence.
Ah, intelligence, unmasking, surveillance. Now, she also admitted that intelligence leaking was taking place. And by the way, in case some of you people don't know, that could very well be a felony. Take a look.
I became very worried because not enough was coming out into the open, and I knew that there was more. We have very good intelligence on Russia. So then I had talked to some of my former colleagues, and I knew that they were trying to also help get information to the Hill.
How did you know there was intelligence? You were out of the administration. How did Evelyn Farkas, a former Obama administration official, a private citizen working for the Hillary Clinton campaign, know about the surveillance and intelligence? Well, during an interview on CNBC earlier today, Farkas, well, she seemed to be walking back and changing her tune. Watch her contradict her own self. Straight ahead.
People are accusing you, Evelyn, of admitting that there was surveillance, admitting that there was unmasking, and urging people, or at least saying that intelligence leaking, which could be a felony, is the way that it should get out. And you weren't even part of the government at that point.
No, so I was referring to the motivation, because there had been a lot of discussion in the media about why are people leaking. And so I was trying to, but in a very shorthand fashion, explain at the very end of that quote that people were leaking because they were afraid of a cover-up. I do not, absolutely do not condone leaking. You know, it's against the law.
Wait a minute. She said earlier, get as much intelligence as you can. Get it up to the Hill, to our friends. So now opposing leaking, even earlier this month, she was obviously claiming to encourage it. Now Farkas also played dumb on what information she was referring to. Watch this walk back. This is interesting.
Sean Hannity and others have made a big issue of this. And I wanted you just to explain what you meant by that. And in particular, when you talked about if they found out how we knew, what do you mean by how we knew?
Well, what I was getting at was the fact that we were having now a transition of power from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. And if indeed there was an investigation ongoing, if indeed there was information that the Obama administration had about Russian interference and possible American involvement, I wanted to make sure that Congress knew about it.
Was there a specific piece of information that you were concerned would disappear?
No, I did not know what the information was or what I suspected that they had information. Again, knowing what I know about our intelligence community, they're very professional. They have a very good eye on Russia.
If indeed, now she says, if it's suspected, but wait a minute, this is the same woman that said if, meaning the Trump folks, found out how we knew what we knew, not if it happened, if they knew what we knew about there, the Trump staff dealing with Russians. Now, try as she might, Dr. Farkas cannot walk back her original comments. And today, we have also uncovered an interview that Dr. Farkas did back in February with Vox before that appearance on NBC. She was asked by Ezra Klein what her, quote, level of alarm was after Flynn's resignation. Here's Farkas' response, quote, well, it's lower than it's been since the summer when I was first made aware of all this stuff. I'm like, finally, everybody else sees it. Seriously? The reason I was so upset last summer was that I was getting winks and hints from inside that there was something really wrong here. I was agitated because I knew the Clinton campaign and the world didn't know. But I didn't think it would happen this fast. I didn't think Flynn would survive a year, but I thought it would be most of the year. Well, did she know about Flynn, the intelligence that eventually got leaked that took him out? What is she talking about here? Anyway, who was giving her the winks and the hints over the summer? Now, I'm just asking questions based on her own words. Here's where it gets interesting. Today, during another interview on MSNBC, Farkas said she's now the victim of fake news because we play her entire comment in context. I'm not kidding. Watch this.
And on the dark campaign of fake news, you know, that's still ongoing. We see even someone like myself get swept up in all of this.
Right.
You know, when people like me are speaking on behalf of process, people spin it to suit their needs. And I think it may be that the Russians are behind even such fake news today. Right.
Maybe the Russians put these words in my mouth asking about surveillance, unmasking, and leaking intelligence. I'm simply asking questions based on what she said, as other members of the mainstream media, by the way, continue to ignore the facts in this case. The media doesn't want to focus on this today. Oh, no, they want to focus on the New York Times headline that came out late this afternoon. Two White House officials help give Nunes intelligence reports. Now, the headline is deceptive, obscure, and I would argue purposely dishonest. If you read further into the report, it isn't really a story. It just says the official, quote, played a role. Now, tonight I'm calling on the intel community. Stop being distracted by the hate Trump media, destroy Trump media. The Attorney General, General Sessions, needs to convene a grand jury. And the only thing we know for sure is that the intel was leaked about retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. That is a felony. That is a crime. And as for Dr. Farkas, well, we need to know what she knew about the unmasking, about the surveillance, and when she knew it, and who she was communicating with, and who was giving her the information. And what did she know also about leaking or getting the information to her friends on the Hill?
What did they know? When did they know it? We hear that a lot. That's a question that probably goes back to the time of Watergate. And I've heard some people talking on the news. I can't remember if it was something I heard or something I read. But the suggestion was, and again, we've got to go back to this particular demographic, the average median age of people in the United States is 37.5 years old. These people don't know anything beyond what empty-headed liberal professors have told them about Watergate. But I'm not even going to get into all that right now. We talked about it a little bit. The comment that was made that was that this Dr. Evelyn Farkas, this Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, would be like John Dean in her association with this scandal, which is much bigger and considerably much more serious. But for those of you who are unaware, John Dean, and that was kind of a sensationalistic comment to make, John Dean was a White House staffer. He was a lawyer. He was a White House staffer and basically was in charge, to a large measure, of the subsequent cover-up of the Watergate burglary. And I don't see, excuse me, I don't see Evelyn Farkas as anything close to that. And the reason why is because she's not a White House staffer. I think she is someone who, for the Obama people and the Hydra agents, the Obama Hydra agents that are still embedded within the government, she made a remarkably stupid statement in ending her interview the way she did. That's why all the leaking. So, should there be hearings about this, and I have every belief that there will be, she may be similar to John Dean in that John Dean copped a deal and testified to everything they knew, everything he knew about the Watergate. He pled guilty to one charge and served his sentence at Fort Holabird in Maryland. That was it. So she may be similar to John Dean from that respect. And if she hasn't, you know what, I'm sure she's probably already lawyered up. She probably lawyered up within hours of somebody who knows what they're doing seeing that interview and saying, "Did you hear what you said? Did you hear what you said, the last thing you said? You told them that's why everyone was leaking everything." And we got to move on. Pay attention to that lady, Evelyn Farkas, Dr. Evelyn Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S. You're going to hear a lot more about her. I don't know how much more we'll hear from her unless she is in some way compelled to testify in front of some kind of Senate committee, congressional committee. But we're going to hear a lot more about her. And because of what she has said, this can of worms has been opened all the way. Okay, and that's all the time we've got for that, so we need to go ahead and move on. Last Thursday, President Donald Trump met with China's President Xi, and an hour into their dinner, bombed Syria. That's right. The decision came, The decision came as Trump traveled on Air Force One to meet with President Xi at Mar-a-Lago, and an hour into their dinner, like I said, 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles launched and pounded an airbase in Syria. Now, this message that was sent wasn't just for Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin. It was also for President Xi and his North Korean client state. The era, ladies and gentlemen, of a weak America is officially over. President Xi had come to the United States expecting an easy photo op visit. President Trump would urge action on North Korea. Xi would smile coldly and shoot him down. Talk of fairer trade would be similarly dismissed. Then Xi would go home and laugh that the new bold American leader was just nothing more than another paper tiger. Except President Trump, he had a different plan. Instead of Xi showing how tough he could be, Trump gave President Xi a front row seat to a display of American power, and the message was both obvious and subtle. President Xi, along with Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un and Iran's Supreme Leader Khamenei, aren't laughing now. The obvious part was as blatant as a 1,000-pound explosive warhead slamming into concrete and steel, and as obvious as upstaging Xi's efforts to stonewall Trump, while warning that North Korea could be next if the Chinese leader continues to be obstinate. Donald Trump had warned throughout the campaign that he would not be laying his military plans on the table. He even mocked Hillary Clinton for doing so, saying, "You're telling the enemy everything you want to do." His address to the nation came an hour after the missiles had hit. The element of surprise clearly had held. And Xi came away with a very different message. And that message was, of course, that the era of Obama was over. The new guy was bold, and he was dangerous and unpredictable, like many of Trump's American opponents. Xi now understands that the jovial man sitting next to him could and would violate the rules of the game without prior warning. China would have to be careful. There was a cowboy in the White House again. Now, that was the subtle part. Trump doesn't care very much about Assad. What he cares about is American power. Left-wing critics quickly jumped on Donald Trump's opposition in the past to strikes on Syria and his criticism of Obama for not enforcing Obama's red line. But there really is no contradiction. Trump didn't believe that strikes on Syria were a good idea, but once we were committed to this red line by the previous president, then we had to follow through if we're going to be taken seriously. So President Trump enforced Barack Obama's red line, not because of Obama or even Syria, but because of America. Donald Trump said that when Obama didn't cross that line after making the threat, that set us back a long ways, not only in Syria, but in many other parts of the world, because it was an empty threat, a blank threat. President Trump intends to get things done, and he knows it won't happen with blank threats. Ask about whether the strikes represented a message to Xi in North Korea. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson replied, "It does demonstrate that President Trump is willing to act when governments and actors cross the line and cross the line on violating commitments that they've made." President Trump made a statement to the world. And the message in that statement is a lot more subtle than a 1,000-pound warhead, but not a whole lot subtle. All these people on the left, these critics of Donald Trump on the left, now have to change gears and back up and shift and change course, because these people who have been accusing him of having a secret relationship with Russia are now in the process of having to accuse him of ruining our relationship with Russia. Some of his supporters are really upset, too, because they've maintained this dogmatic non-interventionist position, but Donald Trump doesn't make decisions based on ideology. He measures policies against real-world objectives, not abstract philosophies. What he's always wanted to do is solve real problems. The problem that he was solving on Thursday wasn't Bashar Assad. President Trump recognizes that Syria is an unsolvable problem, and little good's going to come of an extended engagement with it. There are no good guys in Syria. There are only Sunni and Shiite jihadis and their victims. Syria is and always will be a dead end. The problem is that Obama thoroughly wrecked American prestige and power over the last 8 years, and that makes it really difficult to get anything done when no one in the world will take us seriously. And President Trump, like many of us, sees North Korea's nuclear weapons as a major threat. But he also sees the crisis as a way to leverage our military might to achieve better trade deals with both partners and rivals. He's not wedded to a globalist or anti-globalist ideology. Instead, he sees every problem as an opportunity. He's not committed to any international coalition, globalist or anti-globalist, except where it temporarily serves American purposes. That's what being a true nationalist actually means. And that's what makes him unpredictable and dangerous to people like Putin and President Xi and Supreme Leader Khomeini and Kim Jong-un. President Trump made a point in Syria. He timed that point for its maximum effect. The point isn't that Assad is a bad man. We know that he is. It's not that he isn't a Russian puppet, though only the lunatic left would have believed that. The point is that Donald Trump is determined that America will be taken seriously. Cruise missile diplomacy isn't new. Bill Clinton fired over 500 cruise missiles into Iraq, not to mention Sudan. Bush fired cruise missiles into Somalia. Obama signed off on firing cruise missiles into Yemen and Syria at terrorist targets. The difference is that Trump isn't just saving face with cruise missile technology. President Trump's real objective is not Now, I'm sorry, I've been mush-mouthing all over the place tonight. President Trump's real objective isn't the Middle East, it's Asia. He doesn't see Russia as our leading geopolitical foe, but rather China. Syria was the opening shot in a staring contest with the People's Republic. The moves in this chess game will sometimes be obvious and sometimes they'll be subtle. And Trump is usually at his most subtle when he's being obvious, and that's what his enemies usually miss. President Trump's first step in Syria was to reestablish physical and moral authority on the international stage, while the president of China had to sit and watch. He humiliated Democrats in their media operation at the peak of their Russia frenzy, and he sent a message that America is back. Now, that's not a bad return on a $60 million investment. We've spent much more in the field with far less to show for it. The Obama era in international affairs ended with a whimper and a hollow Nobel Peace Prize as a trophy. The Trump era in international affairs began with 59 cruise missiles and a big bang. I don't want to make any kind of judgments. And I had said all during the election that I was going to support the Republican nominee, no matter who it was. And that's what I've done. I'm not displeased with anything so far that Donald Trump has done, although there are many people who are really upset. The non-interventionist types, the dogmatic types, are kind of feel sold out, and I think they're being a little too quick in their judgments in terms of what exactly is happening here. By the way, those thoughts that I just shared with you came once again from our friend Daniel Greenfield. I am going to try and get in touch with that guy because I would love to have him come on the show and sit for about an hour and just talk to us about what the deal is. He's an awesome guy. Michael Savage said it the first time I ever heard it said, and a lot of people have expounded upon it, and I believe it to be true. Liberalism is a mental disorder, and there are a lot of crazy ones out there, but the nutbag that we're going to look at right now is Chuck Schumer, who's slowly been going insane like most of the left ever since Donald Trump was elected president. He was in a New York City restaurant, and he ran into Joseph Califano and Joseph Califano's wife, Hillary. Now, these people are power players in the Democrat Party. Joe Califano was Secretary for Health, Education, and Welfare under Jimmy Carter. I mean, he's been around for a long, long time. And Hillary Califano is as liberal as they come, but she had openly admitted that she voted for Donald Trump. And that is an act of left-wing treachery that's so huge that even the sight of this woman was enough to send Charles Schumer into the screaming memes. They were in a restaurant. Okay, now, hold on. This guy's in a restaurant. Now, Joe Califano's an old man. I'm not exactly sure about his wife. You know, that might be one of those kind of deals there. But he was, you know, he was probably in his 50s, 40s or 50s, when Jimmy Carter was president, and he was working as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. So this old man and woman are out for dinner at a restaurant in New York. Charles Schumer sees them. He knows that Hillary Califano voted for Donald Trump. He walks over and starts chewing them out. To the point he was so crazy and he was so weird that Mr. and Mrs. Califano had to end their dinner and leave the restaurant. But that wasn't enough. Schumer wasn't finished, so he followed him out onto the sidewalk and started yelling, "She voted for Trump. How could you vote for Trump? He's a liar." This is an old man and woman that were just out having a Sunday night dinner. And because this woman didn't vote the way Charles Schumer thought she should, he lost his mind. Thankfully, the Califanos were able to escape what could have possibly been mob violence by their refusal to acknowledge this crazy SOB, Charles Schumer, very wise decision. Considering the inherent suicidal risks in confronting crazy people, even if he wasn't wearing a tinfoil hat, but rather the crown of the Democrat Party. So, but to be fair to Charles Schumer, who's been under a lot of pressure, he's been towing a very emotional line when it comes to Donald Trump, driven to crying in public just months before by the president's executive order to temporarily restrict immigration from seven terrorist-infested Muslim countries. And while Donald Trump openly mocked Schumer's weep fest, that presidential jab wasn't delivered because it was a Democrat crying over what a Republican had done, but it was rather kind of couched in tough love. Public tears for a man should be used judiciously. A kid's birth, a son, a daughter, a grandson, a nephew. Anything combat related, or maybe hitting a long odd superfecta. But you don't tear up and whine and sniffle and cry to protest a ban on ISIS terrorist thugs coming into the country to bomb a suburban mall. Or to rape a 13-year-old girl. Your 13-year-old girl. But what we see with clearly what is, you know, you can only call it a mental collapse. It's just one screwy little part of a broader liberal crack up that, you know, every day you got women wearing vaginal helmets and men thinking they're girls and girls thinking they're men and men and girls thinking they're animals. I mean, just all kind of weird stuff. And the irony is these people that are wearing the vaginal helmets, what was that crazy woman? Ashley Judd. Salah O'Day. Chris Matthews. These people are the ones that say that Donald Trump is crazy. Which is like the director of a psychiatric hospital being clinically diagnosed insane by the patients in the persistent delusional disorder ward. These people have lost it, and they're going to continue to lose it. And I got to shut things down, man. We're almost out of time. But this is where they're at. The media has lost any pretense of objectivity or partisanship. You have a shadow government, a secret government, an anti-America government. And the Hydra. Remember the Hydra. You cut off one head, two grow back to take its place. That's what we're facing. And the two heads that grow back are even more liberal and crazier than the head you cut off. Folks, that's all the time we've got. I have enjoyed this opportunity to get to talk with you. And this is something new. It's kind of experimental. ACP will be heard live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, here at the Patriot Nation Radio Studios on Blog Talk. You can also hear us throughout the week on the Red Nation Rising Radio Network, on the Internet Conservative Radio Network, WSTR Digital Broadcasting. And we thank you so much for the opportunity. Lots of great hosts here at Patriot Nation, an outstanding stable of hosts and programs at the other three networks I talked about, WSTR, the ICRN, and Red Nation Rising Radio Network. Thank you guys so much. We'll be back. I was going to say see you next week, but that's not exactly the case. We'll be seeing you here in just a couple of days. We'll be seeing you next Thursday. Well, this coming Thursday, actually. And our guest is going to be Don Johnson. No, not that Don Johnson. This Don Johnson is the new head. He's the new chairman of the Veterans Party. And we're going to have him on for a little while and talk with him about what's going on inside the Veterans Party and the ground they've gained and what lessons they've learned from the last election. I'm James Bostic. This is A Conservative's Perspective Good night. God bless each and every one of you. We'll see you in a couple days.